This is an ABC podcast.
Good morning, warm Pacific greetings, and welcome to Pacific Beat. My name is Jordan Fennell, and today on the show, despite having only 8 recorded cases of COVID-19, new antibody testing in Papua New Guinea suggests that the number of infected persons could have been higher. It also comes as 66 people who are meant to be in quarantine for 14 days now can't be located. You'll hear all the latest updates on this in just over 20 minutes. And have you heard of the AILA test? It's a way to measure how Indigenous women are represented in mainstream media like books, movies and TV shows.
People will ask me, they'll say, did you see this movie? What did you think about it? And I have to like mentally prepare myself to watch the movie because I'm afraid of what I'm going to find.
You'll hear more from the creator of the AILA test a bit later on. But first, the University of the South Pacific saga continues as former students call on Australia and New Zealand to help resolve the crisis.
Students and staff.
You're listening to Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia.
The crisis at the University of the South Pacific has escalated after the suspension of the region's premier institution's popular vice-chancellor last week. Student representatives have refused to meet with the interim vice-chancellor after the removal of Professor Paul Aluwalia. His suspension comes after he raised concerns about governance issues and financial mismanagement under his predecessor. Meanwhile, a prominent former USP student says its future as a regional university is at risk, and Australia and New Zealand need to take a more active role in resolving the situation. Liam Fox reports.
Students and staff have been asked to wear black on USP campuses around the region today to show support for the suspended Vice-Chancellor, Professor Paul Aluwalia. After his suspension, representatives from the Students' Association says they were invited to meet with the interim Vice-Chancellor, Professor Derek Armstrong, and Pro-Chancellor Winston Thompson. But the association's vice president, Viliami Nalivu, says they refused because Professor Armstrong's appointment did not follow proper processes.
There is a clear breach of the university on governing bylaws and policy.
So in short, an interim vice-chancellor should have been appointed by a full meeting of the council.
Absolutely correct.
Mr. Nalivu says students feel Professor Aluwalia is a good leader who's doing a good job and should be reinstated.
The students are disappointed and have noted that VC Paul has brought about so many changes around USP. His humbleness, his kindness, and also the students want VC Paul to stay and continue to improve the education system.
Professor Aluwalia was suspended by the USP Council's Executive Committee over allegations of material misconduct, and no further details have been released. Problems have been brewing at USP since last year when Professor Aluwalia raised concerns about governance issues and financial mismanagement at the university under the previous vice-chancellor. The concerns were outlined in a confidential report that was leaked to the media, and pro-chancellor Winston Thompson was among those named in the report. Many students and staff feel Professor Aluwalia's suspension is an attempt to shut down the investigation he initiated. But it's not only current students and staff that are worried about the university's future. Dr. Colin Tukui Tonga studied at USP and went on to serve as Director General of the Pacific Community. He says the Vice-Chancellor's removal is outrageous.
It's clear that the Pro-Chancellor and presumably the Fiji government is trying to get rid of the new Vice-Chancellor for whatever reasons, and they have little regard for other members of USP, but clearly Fiji is putting their own needs ahead of everyone else at this point.
He says the regional nature of the university is at risk, and if the situation is not resolved, it could fall apart altogether.
Well, I think that would be disastrous because it's clear from the statistics over the years that the presence of USP has made a difference in terms of tertiary education, particularly for women. And it's clear that on their own, island members would struggle to offer that kind of tertiary education to its citizens.
Dr. Tukui Tonga believes USP's major donors, Australia and New Zealand, need to take a more active role in resolving the crisis.
I think it's time for Australia and New Zealand, being the large funders, to try to influence some sensible direction for USP. It's clear that the council has been sidelined.
Australia's Department of Foreign Affairs and Trade told Pacific Beat it is very concerned about the leadership situation at USP and that Australia takes governance issues seriously. New Zealand's Ministry of Foreign Affairs and Trade has said it is closely monitoring the situation. Nauru's President Lionel Angamir sits on the USP Council and has called for an urgent special council meeting to reverse what he described as the illegitimate decision to suspend Professor Alu Walia. Pacific Beat has sought comment from council members from other Pacific states.
Liam Fox reporting there, and Australia's Foreign Minister Maurice Payne has echoed those calls for a special meeting of the USP Council. She said that it's important to find an acceptable solution for all Pacific countries and one that is in the best interests of the university and education in the region.
Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia.
Some Pacific workers here in Australia are breaking their silence and today speaking out about their disappointment in the relatively new Pacific Labour Scheme that's meant to be a win-win for them as well as Australia's food industry. They've had their shifts at a meat processing factory slashed because of the impact of COVID-19, but they've still had large amounts of money deducted from their weekly pay, leaving one worker with just $56 one week. In the past, many workers have been reluctant to speak out, fearing they will be sent home. But workers from Fiji, Vanuatu and Samoa in the New South Wales town of Inverell have taken the risk and spoken with the ABC's social affairs correspondent Norman Hermant, who has this story.
Well before dawn, workers from Vanuatu are busy in the kitchen, cooking meals before heading to work in Inverell in the New England region of New South Wales. There are nine of them living in this house, each paying $150 a week in rent. It's just one deduction from their pay that makes workers like Ellen George believe the promise of the Pacific Labour Scheme doesn't match the reality.
Back home, my family needs money. That's the reason why I came here. With this amount of rent that I'm paying, I don't think it's fair, and I do regret coming here. I just want to go home.
Accommodation fees are just one of the grievances of the workers here. When their shifts at Bindery Beef Processing were slashed due to the COVID economic slowdown, deductions from their pay continued. Ali Ferretti Tuitekali from Fiji was stunned when he saw his net pay for 1 week last month.
It is $56 out from the gross pay, $496. So our pay slip, I was so very sad. I really wanted to go back home when I see my payslip.
Deductions included $105 for flights and visa processing and $37 for a rental bond. There are about 1,000 workers in Australia on the Pacific Labour Scheme, administered by the Department of Foreign Affairs. The workers in Inverell are all under contract with the labour hire company Meat Processors, part of the food industry people group based in Brisbane. The company told the ABC deductions that continued during the COVID slowdown were a mistake and that workers were back paid. Some did later receive up to $150. The company also said the accommodation fee for the houses it rents for the workers includes furniture and all utilities. That's the sound of nine Samoans filing into one house. They're sharing four bedrooms and one bathroom. David Tusa speaks for the Samoans.
It's nine of us here, and all of us are paying $150 per week. We are paying too much.
Back at the Vanuatu house, there's another concern. Benneth Tarabiti says with nine people together, social distancing just isn't possible.
If we have our own room, we can keep distance, I mean, from each other, like 1.5 distancing. But like sharing a room, we just be mingling around together. It's not too really safe for us. Yeah.
Beneth Tatabiti from Vanuatu, ending that report from Norman Hermont. And a spokesperson for Australia's Department of Foreign Affairs has told the ABC that all workers participating in the Pacific Labour Scheme are protected by the same workplace health and safety laws as Australian workers. The department says any Pacific worker with concerns about their workplace or living conditions should raise them with scheme representatives so they can be resolved.
Radio Australia now has a WhatsApp. Just add +61437519385 to your phone. It means you can message Radio Australia from anywhere in the Pacific. So add +61437519385 and send us a message. Tell us what you want to hear and join the conversations on Radio Australia.
My name is Jordan Fennell and you're with me on Pacific Beat. Vanuatu says it's committed to continuing its controversial passports for sale program to keep money flowing into the country as it recovers from Cyclone Harold and the impacts of the coronavirus pandemic. The lucrative scheme allows for people around the world to buy Ni Vanuatu citizenship for about $120,000 without ever stepping foot into the country. The program has come under fire in the past, but the chairman of Vanuatu's Citizenship Commission says with some minor improvements, the scheme can be a massive benefit to the country. Priyanka Srinivasan reports.
When Vanuatu's new prime minister was elected in April, speculation was rife over whether he would make any changes to the country's controversial citizenship program. And with the coronavirus pandemic putting increased scrutiny on international borders, some thought the scheme could fall apart completely. But Ronald Warsall, the newly appointed chairman of Vanuatu's Citizenship Commission, says business is booming.
It has not decreased. It's still the same, and we expect to make the same amount of money that has contributed to the budget last year, which was 12 million. We expect to make that same amount of money this year or even maybe more.
The scheme was developed under the previous government in 2014 and allows Vanuatu citizenship to be sold to foreign nationals. It's brought in significant revenue for the government, about 30% of its total income last year. But it's also drawn heat from international bodies like the European Union, which has voiced concerns over the controls put in place to monitor the program.
One of the concerns to do with the EU and some of the other countries is to do with our due diligence.
Last year, a group of six Chinese nationals were arrested in the capital, Port Vila. The group was allegedly running an online financial scheme targeting people back in China. Before their deportation, it emerged that four of them had successfully applied for Vanuatu citizenship and obtained passports. Cases like those have made it clear to Mr. Warsall that the program needs improvement.
Certainly, under my chairmanship, I want to have a look at how our current due diligence process and checks can be improved.
But the lucrative program might be difficult for the country to give up altogether. Vanuatu is one of only a dozen or so countries that puts its citizenship on the market. Some customers don't even step foot in the country. They may simply want the visa-free travel a Ni Vanuatu passport provides, or to be able to store their money in a tax haven. In Vanuatu, there are no personal or corporate income taxes to pay. Even with the risks posed by the global pandemic, Mr. Warsall says Vanuatu, which has no confirmed cases of coronavirus, is committed to the program.
Obviously, if people have Vanuatu citizenship and perhaps they come from places where there is coronavirus, places like China, where I know a lot of people are buying Vanuatu citizenship, is there a concern that they might come into the country and maybe, make the population more vulnerable?
Yes, I think there is a committee. I think they have there is a committee that looks after these matters. This thing to do with the coronavirus. If there's anything as such, then it would be this committee to look at it. The people coming in, same rules should apply to them.
The same rules should apply. But I guess being Vanuatu citizens, perhaps it might be easier for them to come into Vanuatu, even though they might actually be from other countries that have coronavirus. Is that a worry, perhaps?
Yes, I mean they would lose. I think they would still go through the same routine, like go through, like quarantine and all this. It applies to all nationals,
In fact, Mr. Warsall says that the coronavirus pandemic and the devastation caused by Cyclone Harold in April has only highlighted the need for the citizenship program to continue uninterrupted.
Things bring some money for the country, and especially in a time like this where borders are closed and all this, and then we don't have COVID-19. This thing is making some money for the country. Maybe in the meantime, we need it. I put it that way.
And obviously after Cyclone Harold as well, isn't it?
Oh, yeah, sure. In the meantime, I think the country needs it. So maybe the only thing that the government wants, maybe come up with a program, maybe citizenship by tourism investment or something like that, yes.
Yes, so, but you don't want to stop or reduce the numbers of people buying citizenship?
No, not at this stage. No.
Vanuatu's head of the Citizenship Commission, Ronald Warsall, ending that report from Priyanka Srinivasan. Now it's time to find out about all the weather across the region, and to do that I'm joined by Neville Coop, the director of Nandraki Weather. Good morning, Neville.
Hi, Jordan.
So it looks like the weather is improving across the Pacific this morning.
Yes, look, we have a very big high-pressure system that's moving off the east coast of Australia into the Tasman Sea, and that's going to bring much more settled weather, principally for two reasons. One is that with higher pressure we do have descending air, which is much more settled than, say, low pressure where air is generally rising. So the descending air keeps things quiet and no major weather, no cloud or anything like that. The other thing is that we're getting some cooler and drier air from the south up over the tropics, and that's typical in winter. That brings the cold air that's affecting Australia and New Zealand right now. By the time it gets to the tropics, it's quite mild and pleasant and still low in humidity, so it's really going to be quite a nice weekend once we get through the next couple of days. So things are looking pretty good south of the equator.
Will it be sticking around for both Saturday and Sunday over the weekend?
Yeah, I think it's looking pretty good. This high pressure is going to embed itself into the ocean areas south between Fiji and New Zealand. So that high pressure will just sit there quite nicely and keep things quite settled over the tropics. It's a bit different story down south, of course. Cold fronts moving across, but up in the tropics it's going to be quite nice.
Oh, it sounds lovely. Well, if everyone's out on the weekend enjoying the good weather, of course, remember to keep socially distancing. But Neville Coop, thank you so much for bringing us those updates.
You're welcome.
That was Neville Coop, the director of Nandraki Weather. And if you want to find out more about weather news, you can head to Facebook and search Nandraki Weather. And that's Nandraki spelt N-A-D-R-A-K-I.
Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia.
Now, I think it's time for a song on this Thursday morning. This is Westlife with Uptown Girl.
Let's
Everyone here in the studio just having a bit of a boogie to that song. That was Westlife with their cover of Billy Joel's famous song, Uptown Girl. Now it's time to find out about all the latest news from across the region. And to do that, we are joined by Talia Olatia. Good morning, Talia.
Good morning, Jordan.
So let's start in PNG, where correctional services are being brought in to help COVID-19 operations and to ensure quarantine persons are actually staying in quarantine.
Yeah, they want people to stay put if they are in quarantine. Controller of the State of Emergency, David Manning in Papua New Guinea, made this decision when 66 people who were supposed to be in quarantine could not be located. Mr. Manning said that they are now trying to locate those 66 people, and he said that they have shown they have no regard for the safety of other people. Mr. Manning said that once located, they will be severely reprimanded. And Mr. Manning also said for those who don't comply, their passports will be seized and put through a special emergency order, making that possible. There are currently 313 persons in quarantine throughout PNG, including the 66 who have left their quarantine. And if you think about the people you interact with on a daily basis, it can spread very quickly, especially if there are so many people who are unaccounted for. PNG remains stable, they say, with 8 reported cases, but concerns are still high, especially considering the situation on its western border with Indonesia.
Yeah, that's true. But isn't it right that antibody testing could suggest that the number of people infected with the virus could have been higher?
Yeah, that's right. So you'll remember in Parliament a little over a week ago, the governor of East CPIC, Alan Bird, called on the government to collect local data about the effects of COVID-19. And he cited a study that his province had done that showed 4% of the 1,100 people tested had COVID-19 antibodies in their bloodstream, despite no one in the region testing positive for COVID-19 during the state of emergency. So why these antibodies are so important is that generally when you get infected with the virus, your body produces these antibodies to fight off the virus. So it's a telling sign to show that you've had the virus. That's why you've got the antibodies to pretty much, it's your body's evidence of saying, we fought off something, we're all right now. So obviously, if you haven't had the virus, you shouldn't have the antibodies. Now, Controller of the State of Emergency, David Manning, has said that of a total of 8,639 rapid tests collected through the country, 190 were tested positive for antibodies, meaning that at some time in the past, they could have contracted COVID-19 and recovered. Now, the targeting sample size of 12,000 for antibody research is expected to be completed in the next fortnight, which will give you a better picture of just how prolific COVID-19 was in Papua New Guinea. And this week, the team will focus on Daru and the Fly River in the Western province.
Yeah, well, speaking of Parliament, how's PNG's Public Health Emergency Act coming along?
Yeah, so you'll remember when Parliament resumed last week, they were talking about the state of emergency order, which was supposed to expire, but they extended it for another 14 days. So this Public Health Emergency Bill could be tabled and will effectively be in place once the state of emergency order has been lifted. So the proposed Public Health Emergency Act is ready to be tabled in Parliament in this sitting, and when passed will only operate when there is a public health crisis declared formally by the Governor-General. Deputy Prime Minister and Minister for Justice and Attorney-General Davis Stephen announced that this is to give confidence to the general public, business houses and other stakeholders that the government's positions remains that the current state of emergency will not be extended after it lapses in about a week's time. So they're really pushing to have these measures and, you know, what people can do and how they go about their business moving forward without those state of emergency orders.
Yeah, I mean, considering just how we've seen in other countries how rapidly coronavirus has spread, and we know that it's such an infectious disease, it'll be interesting to see what comes of those 12,000 antibody tests.
Especially with the concerns that everyone always talks about a second wave. Will there be a second wave? So this will all feed into that.
Exactly. Yeah. Well, yeah, well, we've just looked at what's happening coronavirus-wise in PNG. PNG, but what's happening elsewhere in the Pacific region?
Well, yeah, elsewhere in the region, the Northern Marianas has hit kind of an unwanted milestone with two more people confirmed to have coronavirus, bringing the number of cases there to 30. Of the 30 confirmed cases, 19 have recovered, 9 are active, and unfortunately, 2 have died. Radio New Zealand's also reporting that 5 nurses from Fiji have been reportedly detained in Nauru for violating COVID-19 quarantine regulations on the island. And in New Caledonia, another French police officer has tested positive for COVID-19. It's the second case that's been recorded this month. The officer, who was a part of a squad flown in from France almost a month ago, was transferred to the hospital's isolation unit. He'll remain there until he tests negative twice within a 48-hour period.
It's so hard, isn't it? Because there's so little known about coronavirus. I note there that you said a French police officer in New Caledonia who had arrived a month ago has tested positive. So how long this disease stays in the body before, you know, you can find out whether it's there makes this all the more difficult. Mm. But moving on, a well-known American dictionary, Merriam-Webster, is changing its definition of racism after receiving an email from a young black woman. What's happened there?
That's right. I don't know if you ever did debating, Jordan, but it was often a technique that us debaters used to use, is that you would say, the dictionary defines this word as this, as to prove your point. And so what has essentially happened is Kennedy Mitchum is a university graduate, and she emailed Merriam-Webster on the 28th of May, suggesting their definition should include a reference to systemic oppression. Now, Ms. Mitchum has encountered people pointing to the dictionary to prove that they were not racist because of the way they felt towards people of colour. And she felt that the definition in this dictionary needed to reflect broader issues of racial inequality in society. Now, for those people who are not familiar with Merriam-Webster's current definition of racism, here it is in my best debating voice. So, Merriam-Webster's definition of racism is a belief that race is the primary determinant of human traits and capacities, and that racial differences produce an inherent superiority of a particular race. It's a doctrine of political programs based on the assumption of racism and designed to exclude its principles, and be a political or social system founded on racism, racial prejudice, or discrimination. So they, like Ms. Mitchum said, there's nothing in that about systemic racism. So Ms. Mitchum said the dictionary definition was being used by people attempting to tell her that she was wrong, and people were essentially copying and pasting the definition to her on social media to prove that racism could only exist if you believe your race to be superior to another, without going into those, you know, more systemic ways that racism manifests in societies and in communities. Now, as I said, Ms. Mitchum sent that email on the 28th of May. I don't think she really expected a response, but she got one the very next day, very surprised by it. And Merriam-Webster's editorial manager, Peter Sokolowski, told the BBC that the wording of the second definition of racism will be, quote, even more clear in our next release. He also added it could be expanded to include the term systemic, and it will certainly have one or two example sentences as at least. I often find examples are very helpful in dictionaries to ensure that people understand exactly what that definition means. And he said that the people at Merriam-Webster will be working on the new definition and will be consulting the work of expert in black studies, which is very important. And he added that the revision could be done by August. So, yeah, new definitions of the word racism in the Merriam-Webster dictionary.
Yeah, they've really jumped on that, which is excellent news. I feel definitely that the notion that racism is systemic is often by white people considered not, it's easy for them to get out of saying that they are racist, but claiming, you know, that, you know, they're not overtly racist.
Yeah, because it's very different to saying to someone, I'm going to call you a name based on the colour of your skin, which, you know, most people know that that's not appropriate. But there are things that have racial undertones that isn't that name calling, but still affects people on from a racial perspective. So acknowledging that in a dictionary, so next time someone tries to get their definitions out, someone can go, actually, no, it clearly states exactly the point I'm trying to make.
And, you know, obviously it's great that this young woman has gone, you know, above and beyond. Obviously it shouldn't be on her to have to do that, but it's wonderful that she has done it and that Merriam-Webster has responded so well to it. So, Indeed. Well, thank you, Talia, so much for bringing us those stories.
Thanks, Jordan.
That was our reporter, Talia Olatia, bringing us stories from across the region.
Big ideas on Radio Australia.
Driverless cars are currently being trialled in every Australian state and territory. It's early days and we're a long way from a future where autonomous vehicles rule. But the technology's developing fast. So why choose autonomous vehicles? Just because we can, should we?
Casting light on some of the big issues and challenges of our time.
A recent report by McKinsey & Co. predicts the winners and losers from automation and artificial intelligence.
On average, we'd see over the next decade or so, around 25% of jobs in the most likely scenario not required. Some industries will be hit harder than others. Transport and manufacturing, which will be increasingly automated.
And discussing age-old questions.
Do animals have emotions? This question is hotly contested.
Be part of the conversation with Big Ideas on Radio Australia.
My name is Jordan Fennell and you're with me here on Pacific Beat. Now, the Black Lives Matter campaign is sweeping the globe, including to Indonesia, where advocates say there's a growing awareness of the racism and discrimination faced by Melanesians in West Papua and Papua provinces, which share a land border with PNG. But for many people, they also share much more. They are family. Last year, we saw images of violence against Papuan protesters who took to the streets in mass rallies, demonstrating against police brutality, demanding independence and an end to racial violence. Some of the protest leaders are facing hefty prison sentences, which human rights lawyers and activists say are unjust and excessive. For more, we're joined by Catherine Grau. Good morning, Catherine.
Good morning.
So, Catherine, the Black Lives Matter protests, which started back in the US after the death of a black man, George Floyd, after a police officer knelt on his neck for nearly 9 minutes, is really resonating amongst West Papuans.
That's right, Jordan. Of course, many of our listeners will know that activists and human rights lawyers, as well as human rights groups like Amnesty, have actually long argued for decades that there is this inequity and racism and discrimination in the West Papua region against the people of West Papua. Now, just to clarify, obviously, when we talk about West Papua, that actually includes both the province of Papua and also West Papua provinces that officially became part of Indonesia some 50 years ago after referendum that has, of course, been highly criticised. Now, as you say, last year, thousands of people took to the streets about this actual issue of racism and discrimination, about the way West Papuans are treated in general in Indonesia. And it was sparked by an incident involving some students being called monkeys, but certainly racism and the poor treatment by police as well amongst West Papuans is a regular occurrence, the human rights advocates tend to say. For example, Andreas Harsono, who is from Human Rights Watch in Indonesia, has recently posted a tweet in the last few days, in fact, making comparisons to that death of George Floyd in the US to another in 2016 of a Papuan man in Indonesia. He was said to have had his head stepped on by a police officer. Meanwhile, the human rights lawyer, Veronica Komen, she is Indonesian but is an advocate for the West Papuan movement. She has told the ABC that everyday racism is certainly very common.
West Papuans, they are often be made embarrassed about their identity because they are Melanesians, so they have curly hair and darker skin than the Malay Indonesians. So they are being embarrassed about their own identity. It's not just that, but there are interviews of West Papuan students. They say that, like in public transportations, Indonesians would like pinch their nose, like that classic racist stigma. Racist attitude.
Well, those are just some of the examples there we've heard from Veronica Coleman Jordan. Now, she also has pointed out, and as have many others as well in this area, that they believe there's also a large inequity in the prison sentences which are handed out for West Papuans. There are dozens of people who are currently behind bars for treason, and there's an ongoing case at the moment. Prosecutors last week were seeking prison sentences of between 5 to 17 years for 7 Papuans who are being accused of treason. It relates to those protests last year. Now, they include a high-profile activist, Buktar Tabuni. He is from the United Liberation Movement for West Papua, and prosecutors are specifically demanding 17 years for him and his alleged role in last year's uprising. Now, lawyers, human rights activists and others all claim that these charges are politically driven against people from West Papua. Here is the leader of the ULLMWP, Benny Wender, talking about that.
Many West Papuans have been arrested, particularly 7 political prisoners, 17 years, Agus Kosai, 15 years, and Stephen Idlai, 15 years. These just people mobilized peacefully and they have been leader, so been charged those with the students. And the men who are started just 7 months in prison and go free. And this is the injustice happening.
Well, that's Benny Wender's take on the situation. And just to clarify, who he says received that jail sentence of just 7 months, that was in reference to those who made the initial racist slurs against the students that then prompted the protests, and what he says and others say demonstrates the inequity.
Right, so that's the history behind why this Black Lives Matter movement really resonates with many West Papuans. Have West Papuans been protesting?
Look, we certainly haven't seen any replication of the demonstrations we saw last year in around August in the West Papua region. But here in Australia, for example, there were weekend protests that obviously were largely focused on the situation in the US and also for Indigenous and Torres Strait Islanders here in Australia. But some of the Black Lives Matter protesters at the weekend were wearing the unofficial West Papua Morning Star flag. That is, of course, interpreted as a symbol of resistance and independence. And also in Melbourne at the protests there, a West Papuan student, Cindy McAbori, actually spoke to the crowd. Here's a little of what she had to say.
What happened recently in America and here in Australia, it just reminds me deeply of what's happening to my people back home. You may not ever heard of West Papua, and today might be your first time, but I encourage you to really, really research into West Papua. We are your closest neighbour. We are just north of Darwin. We're your mom. So West Papua resonates with the Black communities in the States and here and with our Indigenous communities and everywhere else in the world, because we feel your pain, we feel your anger, we feel your loss, because those are our brothers and sisters too, those are our mothers, those are our uncles, those are our aunties that have been brutalised.
That was Cindy McAbori. She is a young West Papuan student speaking there at the protest in Melbourne at the weekend. And in Indonesia, I said not really any protests on the streets, but online there's been a new hashtag that's been trending. It's hashtag Papuan Lives Matter, trending on Twitter. It was used, of course, alongside the hashtag Black Lives Matter. Lawyer Veronica Coleman, though, has actually told the ABC that while she has been quite pleased by this interest, and she's seeing particularly young Indonesian students also throwing their support behind this movement, she's also then seeing on the flip side that a lot of these people who have been tweeting in support are actually being targeted by so-called bots. Here she is.
In the wake of Papuan Lives Matter hashtag trending in Indonesia, that these Indonesians were attacked by bots, that they're being stigmatized as pro-free West Papua movement. So it scares them off. And as Reuters investigate, based on Reuters investigation earlier this year, there's this propaganda machine was operated and paid by the Indonesian army.
And just to clarify as well what she's referring to there, she said that Reuters news agency investigation, Jordan, that actually found that last year internet robots were spreading pro-Indonesian government messages on social media during those protests.
And so how has the Indonesian government responded to this latest protest movement?
Not a lot has been said, but Toiko Faiza Saya, who's a spokesperson for the Indonesian Ministry of Foreign Affairs, has told the ABC that, quote, racism has no place in Indonesia and has denied all these allegations of systemic racist attitudes towards Papuans. And he's gone on to say that the incidents of mistreatment of Indonesians who are Papuan are only isolated and they do not reflect the government's policies. But people like pro-independence leader Benny Wenda say certainly they have been heartened as well by the campaign that they're saying, that young Indonesians seem to be supporting them. But he also wants to see more from people in the Pacific, governments in the Pacific, and also here in Australia.
I'm calling to particularly the Melanesian leader and Pacific leader, particularly Australia and New Zealand. This is happening in next door. It's not far from in the Pacific.
Now, we know, of course, some Pacific leaders have certainly been very vocal supporters of the pro-West Papua movement in the past, but there are divisions amongst the different countries. Now, we have seen this year's annual Pacific Islands Forum meeting where all the leaders come together. It's been postponed. It was to be hosted by Vanuatu, and certainly the issue of West Papua was likely to be a point of discussion. So we'll just have to see what happens. There haven't been too many murmurings from leaders in the Pacific as yet in the last few days, but, of course, we'll keep people updated here on Pacific Beat.
Wonderful. Thank you so much, Catherine, for bringing us that story.
No worries.
Coronavirus is all over the news, so here's some simple information about the virus and how to protect yourself and your family. Coronavirus, also called COVID-19, is an infectious disease similar to the flu. Most people who get it recover after mild symptoms such as sore throat and a cough. But it can be more serious for older people and those who are already unwell. Some people have died from the illness. There is no vaccine for coronavirus, but there are some things you can do to protect yourself. Regularly wash your hands with soap for at least 20 seconds. Avoid close contact with people who are sick. Avoid crowded places. Don't touch your eyes, nose, or mouth. If you get sick with mild symptoms, stay at home. Cough or sneeze into your elbow or a tissue. If you develop a fever or difficulty breathing, call your local hospital or health centre for advice.
My name is Jordan Fennell and you're with me here on Pacific Beat. Now, you may not be one of them, but did you know that there are some people who won't watch a film unless it passes the Bechdel test? It's a set of criteria that works out how female characters have been represented in movies and TV shows. And for a movie to pass the Bechdel test, there are three requirements: that there are at least two women featured, that they talk to each other, and that when they do talk to each other, they have a conversation about something that is not a man.
In the 1980s, cartoonist Alison Bechdel observed a frustrating trend in pop culture. Most films only had a single female character. And when there were multiple women in a film, their storylines almost always revolved around men.
Just call him. Say hello.
But there is another test that is not as well known that specifically measures how Indigenous women are being represented in mainstream media like movies, books, and TV. It's known as the AILA test, and it also has three very specific requirements for those books, movies, and TV shows to be able to pass it. Ali Nadi is the creator of the AILA test, and I spoke with her to find out a bit more.
I'm Ali Nadi. I'm the founder of the AILA test. Those are just tests that I came up with to analyze and critique, but also get a conversation started on the way Indigenous people, not just Native American and First Nations, but Indigenous people worldwide, how they're represented in mainstream media, in books and movies and all forms of narrative storytelling.
Ali, I read that you named your test off of the main character from a film that came out in about 2013 called Rhymes for Young Ghouls. Can you tell me a bit about that?
I watched Rhymes for Young Ghouls, and it addresses the residential schools where Indigenous children, First Nations children, were taken by the government and put into these schools to basically be more white. You know, it's like, we're cutting your hair, we're making you dress in this uniform. We are forcing you to speak English. You cannot speak your language. If you speak your language, we'll abuse you. We'll kill you. It was a reality for not just indigenous children in like the 1800s, but indigenous children throughout, you know, the 1970s in the United States and in Canada. So first of all, the main character of Ayla is this amazing female character. She's played by Devery Jacobs, and she's just wonderful and strong and badass. She's surviving through all of these things. And there's a really low point in the film where she is taken to the school, and it's this really difficult scene to watch. But to see her survive through this movie, you know, without being too degraded, you know what I mean? Like, she still has her dignity at the end of the film, and she survives and she makes it and lives to see another day. And that's so inspirational, and it just like really impacted me.
And the Ayla test has three criteria which measures the way Indigenous women are represented on screen. What are these three criteria that you've made?
With the Ayla test, you know, I started like really comparing these other movies with Indigenous characters to Rhymes for Young Ghouls, and started really noticing, you know, these things, that these tropes and these patterns that kept coming up, especially when Native women were represented. And the first one, in order to pass the Ayla test, is that she has to be a main character. She has to be an Indigenous woman. So she could be Maori, she could be First Nation, she could be Native American, Native Hawaiian, Polynesian, Ainu, Sami, any of those Indigenous groups, but she has to be a main character. And usually that doesn't even happen. Like, usually it doesn't happen. Like, if a Native woman is a main character, usually she still doesn't pass the Ayla test. So the other criteria is she doesn't fall in love with a white man, because usually if she's a main character, she's usually the main white guy's girlfriend or wife or something. You know, usually that's the assigned role. And then, of course, the big one, the third and final criteria, is that she cannot end up raped or murdered at any point in the movie or the story. So even if it's like a background, like a backstory, like, oh, she isn't raped during the story, but in the past she was, she still wouldn't pass, because it's still using rape as a character trait or a character arc. And that just happens way too much, especially with Indigenous women.
I know, I was going to say that one really stuck out to me, because I was wondering, from your point of view, what do you think it tells us that is the bar that, you know, a movie has to pass when it comes to representing Indigenous women on screen?
It is. It's so painful, you know, because like I'm very white passing. My mother was white and my father's biracial. He's Anishinaabe and white. And I don't look like my grandmother, but, you know, when you see someone who would have looked like her when she was my age, when you see this awful thing happen to someone who looks like your grandmother or looks like your auntie or something, when you see that over and over and over again, it does something. It's like, there are points where it's like, I'll tell people will ask me, they'll say, did you see this movie? What did you think about it? And I have to like mentally prepare myself to watch the movie, because I'm afraid of what I'm going to find. I'm afraid that I'm going to see this awful, traumatizing, painful thing again. You know, it's like, I don't want to see someone who looks like my grandmother get sexually assaulted. I don't want to see her kill herself. I don't want to see her murdered, you know, to teach some white guy a lesson, more or less.
Do you have any examples of movies that do and don't pass this test?
So before we get into that, I do want to say that passing the test and not passing the test, it's not necessarily if it doesn't pass, it's bad, or if it does pass, it's great, because there is a lot of nuance there. There are lots of great characters that don't pass the Ayla test. And, Kida from Atlantis, The Lost Empire. I don't know if you've ever watched that. It's a Disney cartoon.
I loved that movie when I was a kid.
But Kida, you know, she's indigenous coded. So, you know, she's not exactly, I wouldn't say she's a tribe, you know, an existing tribe of people. But, you know, the coding is definitely there that she's supposed to be of an indigenous inspiration or influence. But she doesn't pass, and I thought she was great.
I guess there's a lot of space there, as you were saying, that nuance. And I guess then, is this test more of a way to just encourage, the movie world and people who are going to be moving into that space to be thinking about those three criteria and how they can better represent women?
Absolutely. Because, like I said, even with the Ayla test, like, you know, you can pass the Ayla test and it's still not that good, you know, like the character could still not be that great. Like the girl in Brother Bear 2 passes the Ayla test, but turns into a bear at the end of the movie so she can be with a guy she likes. I mean, that's not ideal representation. You know, it's just, I really want Indigenous women, but especially young Indigenous girls, to be able to see themselves in these films without feeling shame or trauma, or, you know, like, I can't watch this, I need to turn this off, or, you know what I mean? I want them to be excited that, oh, there's an Indian girl, an Indigenous girl on TV. Oh, she looks like me. And wow, I really relate to her, and she's interesting, and she's going on adventures, or she's falling in love. And, you know, we don't have to be perfect characters all the time, but we should be allowed to be as diverse as, you know, anytime you see a movie with, like, you know, your average white actress.
That was Ali Nadi speaking to me there about the Ayla test, which measures how Indigenous women are represented in mainstream media. And we have our producer Talia Olatia back on the microphone, because Talia, you did your thesis back in university on popular culture, and I'm wondering how this chat resonated with you.
Oh my God. Amazingly so. As someone who grew up and didn't see a lot of brown women on Australian TV, I remember when Moana came out, and it was revolutionary to me, even though I was like 29 and was not the target audience for that movie. It was watching something where you hadn't seen it before made such a difference. And I love pop culture. I love movies. I love books. I love TV. But it is very, very problematic, because it is a very certain representation of what you get. And so when I did my thesis, I was actually looking at the representation of Australian national identity in Who magazine, because pop culture has this really amazing power to kind of tell people what they should be doing and what they should be like without you even noticing it. So you can think that women on shows should be white and they should be blonde, and that's the only way that you'll get the man. And it's like the black actor is often the one who dies early and all that kind of stuff. So being able to have a test that provides some kind of accountability will make such a difference to so many people who yearn to be represented on TV and in movies. And like movies like Moana, movies like Vi, which came out, which was made by 9 Pacific filmmakers, is really changing the curve for young people to feel themselves represented in pop culture. And it also gives them an avenue to think, yeah, I can be an author, I can be a director, this is a space where I am welcome. So I'm all for representation. I'm all for that interview.
No, so important. And it's like that saying, you know, if you can't see it, you can't be it.
Exactly.
And that representation, is just definitely so important. Talia, thank you so much for that.
Thanks, Jordan.
You're listening to Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia.
That is all for Pacific Beat this morning. Don't forget that Richard Hewitt will be along at 3 p.m. PNG time for the afternoon edition of Pacific Beat. But keep listening to ABC Radio Australia and make sure that you are following along with the ABC Radio Australia Facebook page to keep up to date on all the latest news and developments from across the region. Now, you've heard today about the continuing saga with the University of the South Pacific after the suspension of its vice-chancellor. You've also heard about how the Black Lives Movement is resonating with West Papuans. All those stories and more can be found on our website. If you search Pacific Beat into your preferred search engine, you'll find it there. Thank you so much for your company, and I will catch you tomorrow.